3 Republican votes, assuming all Democrats vote against him. Hegseth has been meeting with Senate Republicans on Capitol Hill this week to try to build support ahead of his confirmation hearings. According to the Wall Street Journal, Trump is already considering Florida Governor Ron DeSantis as a possible replacement for Hegseth. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 41 degrees and partly cloudy. In New York City, 38 degrees and mostly cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon. This is the Shai Rana Show with your host, Zain Al-Amin. This is a show that focuses on Arab culture and politics, and it airs every Wednesday for 1 hour at WPFWFM.org and WBAI-FM. Good afternoon. This is Zain Al-Amin with the Shai Rana Show. And I wanted to share a clip with you from Electronic Intifada. But before I do that, I just want to say a few things about what's been happening in the Middle East, in the Arab world. First and foremost, obviously the slaughter of Palestinians continues with the aid of the Biden administration. And of course, all the European nations, or not the people, because I'm in England right now. I'm in London right now, and I just joined a massive demonstration that happens bi-weekly here in London. And this is not a demonstration that goes through side streets. This is a demonstration that goes through the main thoroughs of the city. It was festive. It was multiracial. I've never seen anything more multiracial than this. It was just really an incredible event. And it's been happening so frequently that they've literally set up a market at the end, in the last stretch before the stage, where you can buy books, where you can educate yourself about the world, about Palestine, about the Middle East, about the Arab world, about political tendencies, etc. So the people are definitely, I just traveled to Sarajevo and to London, and even in London, the heart of colonial Britain, basically, there's massive support for the Palestinians, and there's great indignation and disbelief that the world, or rather the governments around the world, are letting this happen. So for one, as this continues, obviously, the other piece of news is the ceasefire with Lebanon, between Lebanon and the entity we call Israel. And of course, you know, as soon as the ceasefire was announced, basically within half an hour after the ceasefire was started, basically, which I believe was like at 4:30 a.m. At their time, there was already southern Lebanese returning home with obviously mattresses and such that they've packed on top of their cars, just like they did in 2006 after that failed invasion by Israel. And they returned home, even some of them returned to basically flat pads, you know, because their homes were flattened, and slept on mattresses and camped out basically in the spot where their home was. So with this ceasefire, of course, we have the most immoral military in the world defying that ceasefire. As expected, they don't obey any laws. They the whole world is set against them. So they didn't obey the ceasefire. Not only didn't they follow the ceasefire, they actually defied the ceasefire 100 times. And this is not according to yours truly. This is according to CNN. They defied it so many times that actually CNN had to tell the truth about that. And it was announced that Israel had broken the ceasefire 100 times. In return, the Lebanese resistance had bombed military positions. Again, confining their targets to military positions, and announced why they did it, despite the fact that Israel was in their defiance. They've bombed houses, they've killed people. This is past the ceasefire. So that's what's happening in Lebanon. The other thing that's happening that I wanted to mention is what's happening in Syria right now. And in Syria, back when there was a Syrian conflict, and we used to say we were against intervention, we're against these entities that are entering Syria. That we were accused of being Assadist, meaning supporting the dictator Bashar al-Assad. But the reality is we weren't supporting the dictator. We were just saying we're against U.S. intervention. And people said, what U.S. intervention? And of course, now they know that not only was the U.S. intervening, but it was funding entities like Jabhat al-Nusra, which is a rebranding of al-Qaeda. This is what, you know, what they were doing back then. And of course, they've been stealing oil from Syria. They have military positions near the oil interests in Syria. And now, as soon as the ceasefire, this is very interesting, and pay attention to this piece of news, is that as soon as the ceasefire with Lebanon was announced, magically these Islamist extremists, Jabhat al-Nusra, that are being called the rebels, Syrian rebels, took Aleppo and immediately banned things like churches or Christianity in general. They made all the women wear burqas. Beheaded Syrian soldiers in public places. This is basically the act of ISIS. And this is with the support, by the way, and the U.S. government will deny this, with the support of the U.S., with the support of Israel, and with the support of the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. This is the kind of thing that doesn't happen coincidentally. You know, they didn't go into that area coincidentally. The timing wasn't coincidental, in short. This is deliberate, to cut off basically the axis of resistance, which, whatever you may think of Bashar al-Assad, Syria is a passageway, basically, to supply the Lebanese resistance. And so that's what they're trying to do, these extremists, some of the most depraved people, basically second only to the Israeli military. These people are have no morals, despite that they claim that they're Muslims, and everything they do, including simple things like, or rather when they, for example, ban churches, ban Christmas, ban Christians in general, and call them infidels, it doesn't really sync with Islam. Islam considers Christians and Jews as people of the book. So they're really defying the Quran, they're defying the Sharia on all its strands. So that's what's happening in Syria. We need a whole show really on Syria and hope to provide you with one. For now, let's have a listen to the Electronic Intifada interview that really addresses why is it that Israel's attempt at shock and awe, it has lost, in its attempt, it has lost its awe, in a sense that people are no longer amazed or surprised even at the actions of this depraved nation, of this depraved state, of this violent military that brags about killing children and raping men and women. And so basically the title of this piece is how Israel lost its awe.
Just a reminder, you're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Ali Abu Nu'ama here with my colleague, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and we're happy to be joined by a friend who we haven't seen for a little while and we've missed very much, Abdel Jawad Omar. He is a Palestinian scholar and theorist who focuses on decolonization, the politics of resistance, and the Palestinian struggle. He is a lecturer at Birzeit University in the occupied West Bank. Abdel Jawad, welcome back to the Electronic Intifada live stream. We have missed you very much.
Yeah, I have missed you back, Ali and Nora.
Thank you very much. Of course, you have been very active. You write, you appear on programs, and you share your thoughts with the world. And we're looking forward to hearing some of them today. And let's start with the results of the U.S. elections, which now seem like a million years ago, but they were only earlier this month.
Yeah.
In your reflection on the Democratic Party's loss in a recent piece you wrote for MondoWise, you write, "What is perilous in this moment is not just the ease with which the Palestinian movement is raised up as a scapegoat for the Democrats' failings. It is the ominous reality that, rather than reckon with their unrestrained allegiance to Israel, the Democrats will choose to turn inward, punishing their own base for failing to heed the cries of the looming threat of Trump." And you add that this election defeat isn't just about Palestine, it's about how Palestine crystallizes a multitude of other failures. I'll also add that during the election, we were told that Kamala Harris was working tirelessly for a ceasefire in Gaza, and yet freed from the constraints of the campaign, the lame duck Biden-Harris administration has just vetoed a UN Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire for the fourth time in a row. Of course, we could debate the value of such resolutions, but that's beside the point. They wouldn't even take the symbolic step of voting for it. But talk to us, Abdel Jawad, about the ways you think the Democratic Party's full participation in the Gaza genocide, and which has now expanded to Lebanon, cost them the election. How do you explain their commitment and perhaps the commitment of other Western liberal parties? We could include in that the Labour Party in the UK, the Greens and the Social Democrats in Germany. How do you explain their commitment to genocide above all else, even putting support for this genocide before winning an election, which the Democrats told us was about nothing less than saving American democracy from dictatorship and fascism?
Well, I think, there's a multitude of you know, answers or approaches to answer your question. And one of them is, first and foremost, there's this kind of tension, at least, that we should place front and center in our analysis of how the Democrats dealt with the defeat. Because at one level, they want to discard that Palestine was an issue. Because if they want to admit it publicly that it's an actual issue that needs to be tended to, that needs actually a shift in policy. So they have to keep it away or turn it into this kind of Muslim Arab issue that is only relevant to Michigan and what happened or unfolded with Arab voters or Muslim voters in Michigan. But at the same time, what happened almost immediately after the election results came through is that there's, you know, a lot of anger from a lot of liberals towards this whole issue of Palestine, which tells us something about, first of all, how Democrats saw themselves as culpable and also punishable by participating in this genocide, because they realize that it's morally indefensible and that it should perhaps cost them the election on one level. But on the other level is that they're unable to really reckon with it as a as an issue that needs a shift or signals even a shift. I mean, Kamala Harris had a lot of opportunities to actually signal a shift in policy or do something that is completely different than Biden, or answer questions around Palestine in a different manner, in a different way, perhaps energizing and mobilizing some of its base, perhaps easing some of the concerns of a lot of people who play a big and important role in the mobilization on the ground for the Democrats, and who basically perhaps stayed at home in this election. But I think what's important as well is that Palestine refracts back as a constellation of other factors. If a wide base of supporters who asked repeatedly for policy to be changed, you know, had their calls, you know, reach deaf ears, why would they change any other policy? Why would they care about any other issue, whether it's inflation, whether it's the economy, whether it's healthcare, whether it's any other issue that could actually matter to the voters, you know, in the United States more broadly and for the Democratic base more specifically? So I think this whole joy campaign that Harris tried to lead, you know, Palestine played a big role in how the loss came about. Again, not as a singular issue, not as a foreign policy issue, but as a policy, as an issue that crystallizes a lot of other failures, including inflation, including revealing to many voters the extent of the moral corruption and indistinction between Democrats and Trump. I mean, at the end of the day, Biden looked exactly like Trump in terms of their support, or both of them, their support for Israel and for the genocide that is going on in Gaza. Mm-hmm. So that played an important affective role. It played an important role in terms of how this election actually went or served the rise of Trump again. That's one level of the analysis. But to your question, I mean, why would they support Israel no matter what, no matter what the cost? And this is what's the importance, I think, and centrality of Palestine, again, not as a cause for Palestinians, but as this kind of universal cause, because it tells us something about what Israel means to this global order that we live in, to capitalism and its structures, to ideological and psychic investments in this state that is called Israel. They're all kind of tied together in this kind of condensed place that is called Palestine. And it tells us that there is a lot of, you know, elements that go into it, whether it's, you know, settler identifications, you know, America being a settler state itself, feeling the sense of identity or identification with these new settler colonialists trying their luck in the Middle East, or whether it's the fear of, you know, the other, the Islamic other, the rise of a new Islamic or Arab empire in that region that could, you know, challenge Europe on some level, which with this long history of give and take between Europe and various Islamic and Arab empires that, you know, existed on the other side of the Mediterranean, or whether it is, you know, capitalism and its militarism and Israel's role in this kind of military industrial complex that exists across the globe, or whether it's Germany's, you know, sense of guilt and redemption through allowing genocide to happen. What appears, you know, again and again is that Israel is situated in this kind of exceptional domain where it's untouched or should not be touched by policy concerns, by electoral politics, by democratic you know, voices raising concerns or critiques, and all these critiques need to be shut down and even criminalized and you know, placed on hold or not listened to. So it creates this kind of, you know, tension, and these tensions also lead to implosions, and that's what we saw happen with the Democrats. That's what we see also happening in other domains, at least when it comes to how Palestine both kind of is able to penetrate international institutions like the ICC, but how the discussion around Israel and Palestine when it comes to the ICC leads to American threats of invading the Netherlands, for example, or you know, so you have all these multitude of issues that Palestine can actually crack and unravel for the world, and not only for Palestinians, but also for people living in the UK, for people living in Canada, for people living in the United States. They can see with their eyes, you know, the type of class alliance that rules them, the type of ideology that this class alliance has, why this class alliance rather have Americans, you know, pay the brunt of inflation rather than doing something about inflation other than pushing it on consumers and American citizens. It tells us something about the world we live in as a whole. And that's why, again, Palestine is not this kind of singular, faraway issue that relates to Palestinians only.
I wanted to jump in because I think that's an important point. We talked about it in a previous show, that the election, the role of Palestine in the election was not just about Palestine. And to make that make sense, I think of, I'm looking at this article that appears in the New York Times on the cover, and this is on Monday, November 25th, where it says that universities have cracked down very viciously on pro-Palestine activism, as we know. And it says that the crackdown seems to be working. And it's sort of a congratulatory article about how the repression, including arrests, police raids, draconian rules, emergency powers for university administrators, all sorts of things, are quote unquote working. Of course, the article does contain criticisms of this crackdown from the perspective of, you know, civil liberties or free speech. But then, in a sense, the last word is given to those they identify as Jewish students, who feel relieved because, you know, they're not being faced with all this anti-Semitism on campus. So it's claimed. Of course, the article uncritically associates being Jewish with supporting Israel, which in itself is an anti-Semitic trope. But the point I want to get to here is this article makes no connection. It seems to be about, you know, it's about what's happening in the universities. It doesn't mention the election. It doesn't mention the defeat of the Democrats. It doesn't mention Kamala Harris at all. But I wonder if there is a connection between this sort of crackdown on an entire generation, this demonization of an entire generation of university students, and they don't even ask the question as to whether this played any role in millions and millions and millions of people refusing to come out and vote for the Democrats, the people who would be their natural constituency. I just find it remarkable. And so, I mean, kind of as a follow-up, I want to ask you about your sitting in Palestine doing this very thoughtful analysis and writing about it. Why are they incapable of doing this? Why are they incapable of understanding why they lost? And I'll just say to that, in all of the post-election analysis, and you'll find every crazy theory as to why the Democrats lost on the pages of the New York Times or Washington Post or MSNBC, and they will just remain completely silent about, let's call it, the genocide factor.
Well, I mean, if you're going to recognize it, what does it create? It creates a moment where policy has to change, no? I mean, then Palestine is good policy. It's not a burdensome policy. It doesn't lose you votes. It actually gains you votes. It's one that could actually energize their base, fold in a new generation and mobilize them and energize them. So if you're going to actually elevate it to a, you know, a point of analysis that makes sense, then you have to actually deal with that fact and change your historical policy of being tied so intimately to this settler state in the Middle East called Israel. So I think that that's one element of it, Ali. Why they don't want to do it, because I think Israel has a lot to do with, you know, imperial ambitions of America. It has to do with, you know, again, psychic political investments. Of course, there's the power of lobbies as well. And you all know, I mean, and I'm sure that throughout this year, we've been getting a lot of, you know, talks by Mearsheimer and by different people who have different point of views of why Israel has such a hegemony over U.S. Foreign policy more broadly. But so you have this kind of imperial ambition in tension with a fact that is now coming to the fore, that Palestine is actually a policy that makes sense electorally, at least on some level, at least in terms of being morally consistent, at least in terms of actually creating a moral distinction between you and Trump, at least in terms of, you know, trying to create a different image, a direction in the minds of those who care most about Palestine and who are not only the Arabs and Muslims of Michigan, but are, you know, a large swath of the electoral base and a lot of the energetic, you know, people who were on the ground and who care deeply about this issue and who see it as also a test, a moral test, a moral compass through which they can measure, you know, the willingness of the Democrats to actually truly change politics in the United States and the economy in a way that works for working class people and for people of color, etc. So I think that, you know, there is that problem, there's that tension. And I think for the Democrats, it's best to keep it under the rug and slowly but assuredly raise this whole issue of anti-Semitism to the fore that we have been repeatedly bombarded with, which works in different ways. No, it scares people off at one level. It also gives people who are hesitant or who actually have anti-Palestinian, you know, bias or who hate Arabs and Muslims a way to articulate their grievance against the Palestinian issue through this kind of lens of anti-Semitism. It gives people an excuse to remain silent as well by fearing for their careers through this ability of the Zionist lobby to smear them with, you know, anti-Semitic remarks if they're going to stand for the truth of what's happening in Palestine. So anti-Semitism becomes this you know, catch-all phrase through which, you know, the Israeli Hasbara machine is working either to maintain silence or to create controversy or to kill personalities and you know, make them choke on their own words. And this is part of this politics of choking that we have been seeing quite, you know, viscerally in the United States with many intellectuals, public figures, unable to really take a stance when it comes to what's going on in Palestine and raising their voice in a way that matters. So, I mean, this is what we're going to see. I mean, and we're going to see what's happening in the universities also, you know, choking civil society. Now, I think there's a law being passed in the U.S. Congress around civil society organizations also attempting to, you know, shrink the space for organizing around Palestine, organizing around, you know, backing the Palestinians' rights for self-determination, for a life of dignity, etc. So we're seeing also these kind of law warfare that is also unfolding in front of our eyes, which means increased criminalization, attempting as much as possible to keep Palestine under the rug. Although it has become in the past year so important and relevant, because what the past year has told us is that the hegemony of Israel over the imagination of the American people, over you know, the political outlook of many, I don't want to exaggerate and say most of the American society, etc., because, you know, at least those politically active, at least not only the progressive but also from a large base of the population who see what's happening in Palestine and simply cannot fathom how the Democrats are backing it with full force.
Abood, shifting to what a Trump administration may mean for Palestinians and the broader region. You write in your Mondo Weiss analysis that, quote, there's something almost redemptive in witnessing Trump's ascent to the American presidency. What do you mean by that? And what does it tell us about where the Democratic Party has really situated itself as being, you know, like for many people, I've been talking with so many people the past few weeks about, you know, since the Democrats lost, about how, you know, the Democrats maybe would like to be more of an opposition party than actually, you know, change any of their policies, listen to their constituents, and perhaps win an election. They would rather be the hashtag resistance. They would rather fundraise off of their loss, because they get the same policies that you know that they've, because Trump will enact the policies that the Democrats quietly really want. You know, this move, this very like you know, it's not even incremental. It's like every 4 years you can see just how more right wing the Democratic Party becomes, the policies that it adopts. And the really, you know, the kind of cohesion between so-called Democratic values and the Republican Party, the, you know, Christian right-wing values. So what do you mean by the redemption in seeing Trump's return to the White House?
Well, I mean, when we were growing up in Palestine, I mean, when you had these cocky, arrogant foreign journalists coming into Palestine, like the Tom Friedmans of the world. And they would come and, you know, look at our leaders and say...
No relation, by the way. I just want to...
No, I'm not. they would come in and, you know, accuse Arafat of being corrupt. I mean, I'm not saying that these accusations are not, but they would treat us with this kind of disdain and disregard, and, you know, talk up our leaders as buffoons, charlatans, as, you know, liars, as corrupt, as you know, trade, whatever it is, and they do it in this kind of cocky know-it-all manner. And I mean, yeah, there's a bit of, you know, revenge. I mean, it's a childish one. I mean, I'm not saying it's a you know, but it's a childish one, at least on my part, to see, you know, Trump rising in the U.S., to see this kind of populist, obscene figure who, you know, says contradictory things, who's in it for the money, who has no, you know, backbone to back what he really wants, but, you know, can rile up a base, populist. And to see, you know, to see America dancing to the tune of a figure that, you know, they once derided. So there's that kind of childish, you know, vengeful part of it, but I of course this comes with a sobering up, you know, afterwards, if after that kind of, you know, childishness sentimentality that I have, which is that Trump will be as worse, if not worse, than what Biden was. I mean, nobody's expecting Trump to come with policies that would actually end the war. Nobody's really you know, hopeful that, you know, of course, Trump is spoken about as this kind of unpredictable figure that we don't know what he will do. Also a figure that is less beholden to Netanyahu on a personal level. He has his own megalomaniac type of personality and his own ego. And, you know, Netanyahu has his own ego and they might clash. And so there's all these theories going on, you know, how Trump could also, you know, be less of a weak figure like Biden was when it came to dealing with the prime minister in Israel. But I think these kind of interpersonal dynamics are not as important as what sets this kind of unified policy in the United States when it comes to Israel in the foreign policy and intelligence community and in the managers of the empire more broadly. And I think that's what will be, you know, the driving force behind any policy. While personalities matter, it's still going to be this direction, which is to back Israel, to give it as much space, to give it diplomatic cover, legal cover, and help it achieve whatever it says it wants to achieve in its war in Gaza. So I don't think that changes from Trump to Biden in any radically different way, except that with, you know, Trump, we wouldn't see this kind of rhetorical maneuvering around a lot of the policies that Trump will support and back up.
And the Trump administration is not going to pretend to care about Palestinians while starving and bombing them the way the Democrats do. That's for sure. You talked about your own reaction personally. You even called it emotional or childish. But I think it's a reaction that has been shared by many people, and which is that, you know, even knowing that what comes next is not better, I don't want to say worse, because I don't know how there can be worse than what has been done. And to say, oh, Trump will be worse, is in a way a kind of whitewashing of the horror that has happened for 14 months and is happening now as we're speaking. And I don't think, you know, I've said, I don't think Trump has magic bombs, which Biden doesn't have, you know. And to say Trump will be worse is to suggest that Biden has held Israel back in any meaningful way, which we know is not the case. So I get what you're saying, but I just want to add that comment to it. But my question is, I mean, so I think there's a moral reaction in. So what I'm saying is, I think there's a moral reaction in being satisfied that they're lost, because, as John Mearsheimer put it, genocide is a red line. He wouldn't vote for them because genocide is a red line. My question is, what's the reaction you're seeing more broadly among Palestinians? And maybe, you know, maybe the right answer is that the U.S. is not the center of the world, so maybe they don't care that much. But on the other hand, the U.S. is a major factor in this genocide. What's the reaction? And thinking regionally, you know, there's some ideas I've heard, and we're in the realm of speculation, where, you know, Trump had this very sort of special relationship, let's say, with the Gulf regimes through the Abraham Accords. And there was no hiding that all of the Gulf regimes, including Saudi Arabia, wanted to join up to the Abraham Accords, wanted to complete the normalization, but now feel they can't because of the genocide. And they have had to sort of draw lines that say, no normalization until there's a Palestinian state or whatever conditions they're putting. So talk about how you see, without getting into, because as we say, Trump or Biden, it's two sides of the same coin. But in terms of the regional dynamics and the reactions among Palestinians, is there a difference? Do people perceive a difference?
Well, I think on a popular level, no. I mean, I think people don't really care about who comes in, whether it's Biden or Trump. Specifically, you know, among Palestinians more broadly, the way we look at American politics is not much different than the way we look at Israeli politics, which is whether it's, you know, Ben-Gvir or Netanyahu or Gantz, they all look the same to us. From our perspective, from our point of view, they all build settlements, they all want to kill us, they all want to eliminate us, they all have a desire to eradicate Palestinian presence physically, symbolically, politically. So from that vantage point, looking at American politics, I mean, nobody really gives that much of a damn about American politics or who comes in. I mean, some people might watch it out of, you know, just an interest, like watching a sports or watching, you know, soccer or football or whatever. But other than that, that's not really important. But of course, some people do argue that there is these kind of minute differences and we should take them seriously, because one would back more of a right-wing agenda, one would give Israel more of a moral grounding and support its, you know, policies. in a much more voice-first way. I mean, the Israelis were happy about Trump, specifically the current government, its right-wing coalition, including Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, and they wanted Trump to come in. So they see the right wing in America as their, you know, ideological ally, as their kind of politics that they want to see as well, and the kind of president they want to see backing them up in the White House. But as you said, there is also this kind of Trumpian-Saudi relationship, which is being hyped up as also important for Trump himself and his business interest, including, you know, talks about his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who is also, you know, outspoken Zionist and a friend of Netanyahu's family, who's, you know, getting a lot of investment money funds from Gulf countries and, you know, playing with this money around. So, you know, there is all of these factors that come into who will Trump listen to. On the direction of war, will it be that the Gulf countries and their interests being placed first, or Netanyahu and his clique of friends that will be placed front and center in terms of you know, the direction of the war and how it will proceed? And this is not to say that the Gulf countries necessarily would be, you know, totally opposed to the war being, you know, continued, or that they would be forceful in terms of stopping the war, but there might be different priorities among the different allies America has in the region. And, you know, the theory is that Trump will be more receptive to the Saudi rather than the Netanyahu, you know, priorities. That's the idea. And that could backfire in the face of Israel's right wing, which wagered its wage on, you know, Trump coming into the presidency, allowing settlements to come back to Gaza. That's the hope, perhaps allowing for an ethnic cleansing campaign, perhaps pressuring Trump to pressure the Arabs to, you know, open the floodgates of people being forcibly removed from the West Bank and Gaza. So this is all part of the agenda for at least the next year. And that's part of at least what the right wing in Israel will want to see, because they still speak of this kind of decisive plan to end the Palestinian issue. And a decisive plan to end the Palestinian issue means ending the Palestinian people, no less than that. Because even if you return settlements to the Gaza Strip, it only changes the type of colonialism you have. Nothing more or nothing less. It doesn't really change the fact that there's going to be an ongoing struggle, ongoing resistance to these settlements. It doesn't change the fact that, you know, you're still entangled, or you have settlements with a population of Palestinians. But if you want to decisively end the Palestinian cause, you'll have to decisively end, you know, the Palestinian people, which is an impossible task, of course, but that has been the rhetoric that, you know, Israel has been spewing since the beginning of this war, and has tried to follow up through its genocidal policies in Gaza and flirting with that possibility in the West Bank, and also exercising a lot of power in the south, in South Lebanon as well.
Abdeljawad, in a recent essay, you introduce a play on the concept of shock and awe, which was, of course, the U.S. military doctrine that calls for overwhelming force to overpower and confuse an adversary. This is the doctrine, as we all know, that the U.S. used when it launched its aggression against Iraq in 2003. Except you talk about shock without awe. You write, quote, "This shock without awe paradigm continues to serve Israel as it flirts with dangerous fascist ideologies and takes a festive and unapologetic pleasure in its power to punish, kill, maim, and destroy." Can you talk more about that, what you mean by shock without awe, and how it helps us, you know, really understand Israel's deepest strategies and goals, long-term and short-term?
Well, I mean, I don't think it explains strategies, but what it explains is, you know, something about the Israeli psyche, what happened on October 7th, which is this kind of crack and void that opened up in Israel's own self-understanding at this kind of invulnerable power in the Middle East that nobody would dare to challenge. And now the Palestinian resistance, small in the Gaza besieged, you know, could conduct this kind of operation that defeats its, you know, Southern Command and expose its army to be weak and fragile and vulnerable in a way that, you know, shocked Israel and also, you know, in many ways produced this effect of, And that was a success of at least the Palestinian resistance in these first couple of days. And Israel has prided itself not only on being a refuge for, you know, Jewish refugees coming out of Europe and arriving to Palestine as settlers, but has prided itself not only in the security that can provide these those people that are willing to participate in the settler colonial project, but it has prided itself with the ability to exercise military power. And it's built its identity around military power. In fact, one of the earliest readings of what happened on October 7th, I mean, New York Times was doing this article, I forgot exactly when, but you know, this Jewish Israeli novelist writes that, you know, on October 7th, we stopped being Israeli and we returned to being Jewish, you know. And what he meant or what they actually were saying is that we stopped being powerful and now we return to being vulnerable. And, you know, it tells us something also about this relationship between Zionism and Judaism, where the real traumatic encounter for Zionists is with the Jew. It's not with Hamas. It's not with the Palestinians. It's with this idea of the Jew hearkening back to it. And Israel has invested quite a lot historically in building these, you know, military operations that not only, you know, have tactical effect, but would actually render their enemies not only in a state of shock, but also would create or produce this effect of an amazing or awesomeness of power and its display. And what we have been seeing for the past year is that it lost much of that capacity, although with a qualification to some degree, maybe with what they have been able to achieve in some of the operations against Hezbollah, one could claim that there is this kind of combination of both and not all of these operations. But in essence, they haven't been really able to show this kind of heroic Israeli figure.
Yeah. Even in the case of the operations against Hezbollah, you may be referring to the pagers, the pager attack, of course, the assassinations, which would have required the type of mythical intelligence that, you know, we grew up hearing that Israel has this mythical omniscient intelligence ability. But even when they achieved that shock and awe, now I think I'm getting it in real time. There was shock, but no awe, in the sense that within days, people recovered from that sense of shock, and it didn't produce the kind of, you know, you think about how the hubris in the West, in the United States, following the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, that now Lebanon is going to fall into line, the whole Middle East is going to be remade. And that's not what happened. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to Ali, I'm not trying to really speak about strategic or political level on what changes and doesn't, but only the aesthetic level of military operations, because they play this kind of role in like Israeli self-assertion. Like it's kind of a paradigm where, you know, there's an impossible task and we, the Israelis, have the ability to, you know, overcome this impossibility. And this is basically part of the brand. This is actually a large part of how Israel has been able to also attract the diaspora, the Jewish diaspora, you know, this small state in the Middle East fighting against all these monstrous Arabs and defying them and, you know, and creating that kind of narrative around its military power and around the aesthetic effects of its military power. So there's that element to it. I mean, of course, we can discuss to what extent Israel's operation actually incur an effect. But what I think is central here is that since October 7th, what we have seen largely, what you said, is shock without awe, is the ability to create this kind of hellscape that is called Gaza today, where genocide is taking place, is the logic of punishment being enacted in Lebanon. And to be honest, when people are looking at this, they're making the contrast between, you know, a fighter leader like Yahya Sinwar, who fights for the last moment, who's willing to die for the cause, and Prime Minister Netanyahu, who's a liar and whose son lives in Miami. I mean, they're making that contrast quite, you know, alone. I mean, even if you have no real investment in this whole issue and know nothing about it, if you're coming to Mars from Mars and you're looking at this, you know, you'll be more impressed with what the Palestinians have been able to do with their meager resources, with their siege, defying an empire, defying a settler state and defying an empire behind it. And at the same, against, you know, an Israeli political class that is cowardly, you know, when Prime Minister Netanyahu's house was targeted, the first thing he asked for is more protection and millions of shekel being spent on his house to protect him and his wife. That's the contrast between, you know, the heroic nature of and the heroic narrative that Palestinians can produce, as opposed to an Israeli narrative where machines reign and where they fight a post-heroic fight where they seldom have heroes. And, you know, and that plays a role. It plays a role in narrative buildup, in people's, the way they look at this issue, if you want to talk about the political effects of it. But of course, on your
point, there are no Israeli heroes now.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's what I'm trying to say. Yeah, I mean, yeah, there might be some here and there, but, you know, yeah, I mean, that's what I'm trying to say.
But if you take someone like, okay, you refer to, when we say Netanyahu, we talk about one person, but we talk about Benjamin Netanyahu, but there is the mythical figure of his brother, Yonatan Netanyahu, who died in the Entebbe operation in 1970, I think, 5 or 6 or 7, which I think that operation where the Israeli commandos led by Yonatan Netanyahu, the brother of Benjamin Netanyahu, rescuing passengers from a hijacked plane in Entebbe in Uganda, played a disproportionate role in building up that mythical image of Israel as this this invincible state that is capable of doing the impossible with very few resources. And the hero figure in that is the brother of Netanyahu, who, and it was partly on the reputation of his dead brother that Benjamin Netanyahu built up his political career. And, you know, Netanyahu is this just despicable, cowardly, as you say, figure. His son is a coward living in a you know, a high-rise apartment building in Miami, being protected at taxpayer expense, Israeli taxpayer expense, maybe even American taxpayer expense too. But there is no Yonatan Netanyahu, even within the terms of Israeli mythology today, or Zionist mythology. I can't think of any quote-unquote heroic figure today.
No, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, they can't produce it because on one level they depend on machines. The second level, I mean, even if you go back to Sinwar's last stance, I mean, you had this injured fighter without a weapon and they choose to kill him. Although it turned out to be a leader who can bring them a trove of intelligence about the whereabouts of perhaps, you know, Israeli captives, about, you know, Hamas in the Gaza Strip, about the military infrastructure. But they chose to kill him instead of facing him or risking their soldiers. I mean, and that's the, you know, that's a, and of course, it has to do with also the way in which they deal with killing now in Gaza, which is at ease. I mean, there's no real restrictions or limitations on the use of power as well, or it's unleashing. So there are these two components going into it. But yeah, I mean, there's no real heroic figure. I mean, this is a post-heroic society that is fighting a war and using the machines to, you know, enact this massive form of violence and thinking itself that it will not have repercussions on itself or its society for, you know, committing genocide. So that's the reality of how this all comes across for people who are at least slightly attuned to what's going on in Palestine or Lebanon at this particular moment.
Well, finally, it's been almost 14 months since the resistance operation of October 7th, 2023. And the start of the Israeli genocide. Last week, the International Criminal
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire.
Happy holiday. I'm Robin Holden.
I'm Miyuki Williams. WPFW is wishing you a happy holiday and are inviting our listeners to an open house extravaganza as we say goodbye to our 1990 K Street location.
We're offering our listeners and supporters this holiday gathering as a way of thanking you for your support. On Sunday, December 15th, from 4:30 p.m. until 7:30 p.m.,
stellar programmers James Funk,
Captain Fly,
DJ Lance Reynolds,
and DJ Abby will provide the music.
Food and drink will be made available.
Details, including how to RSVP, available at WPFWFM.org.
Happy holidays!
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. South Korean opposition lawmakers submitted a motion today to impeach President Yoon Suk-yeol over his short-lived effort yesterday to place the country under martial law. The motion, submitted jointly by the main liberal opposition Democratic Party and five smaller opposition parties, could be put to a vote as early as Friday. After introducing the impeachment motion, the Democratic Party condemned Yoon's initial martial law declaration as insurrectionary behavior. Meanwhile, the country's largest union group said members would strike until the president quits. Impeaching Yoon would require the support of two-thirds of parliament and at least six justices of the nine-member constitutional court, which would have to endorse it to remove Yoon from office. If Yoon quits or is removed from office under the Constitution, Prime Minister Han Duck-soo will step in to perform presidential duties. In other news, there's a manhunt underway in New York City after Brian Thompson, CEO of United Healthcare, was fatally shot this morning outside the New York Hilton on 6th Avenue in a possible targeted attack. United Healthcare, the largest private insurer in the U.S., was holding an investor conference today, but that was quickly canceled following the shooting. During a press conference, New York City Police Commissioner Jennifer Tisch said it appears the suspect was lying in wait for several minutes and described the shooting as a, quote, brazen, targeted attack, close quote. Police said the shooter fled on foot and then on an e-bike. He was last seen in Central Park. The U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments this morning in a case focused on Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming care for trans youth. U.S. Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar delivered opening arguments against the Tennessee ban and answered questions from justices on gender dysphoria and the history of de jure discrimination against trans people. ACLU attorney Chase Strangio also delivered arguments against the ban. Potential swing votes on the court include Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Neil Gorsuch, both of whom ruled in favor of trans people in a 2020 workplace discrimination case. Another swing vote, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, was not on the court for the 2020 case. Both Roberts and Barrett asked questions this morning suggesting support for the Tennessee ban. The court's other three conservative justices, Alito, Kavanaugh, and Thomas, dissented in the 2020 case, suggesting they will rule in favor of the ban. Supporters of rights for trans people gathered outside the court this morning to protest. And in more news, Pete Hegseth, Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of Defense, is fighting to hold on to his cabinet nomination as some key GOP senators raise questions about his personal conduct and whether he can make it through the confirmation process. Hegseth has already been the subject of accusations of sexual assault from 2017, accusations he denies. But fresh revelations emerged over the weekend involving alcohol abuse and more sexual misconduct in his past. With the GOP's slim incoming Senate majority, Hegseth can afford to lose only 3 Republican votes.